Welcome to Books, Stories, People with me, Nancy Richards. Telling stories of the past is said to be a way of making sense of the present and protecting the future from past mistakes. Well, that's certainly part of the principle of storytelling at the District 6 Museum in Cape Town, where they offer a platform for the histories of the forced removals of the 60s, 70s, when whole communities were moved from the city to other areas based on the colour of their skin. Christiane Julius is the manager of the collections, research and documentation at the museum, where she's worked for the last 17 years, so she certainly heard a story or two. But Christiane herself was born in the last decade of apartheid in 1981, and she has memories of her own growing up during this period, as well as the stories of her own family's forced removals. She's a great believer in the power of oral histories to create an understanding of our past, so we're going to find out exactly how. But right now, COVID restrictions threaten to see the closure of this much-loved museum, which would be an absolute travesty. So they've been running a love letters campaign, which has its roots in the love letters handed out to the victims of the forced removals back in the day. Christiane, lovely to have you, and stories of the love letters. But explain to us the original love letters. What were they?
So when the museum first started in the 1990s and we officially opened in 1994, people would speak about these love letters that they used to receive from the government. And obviously it sounded a bit odd to the people working at the museum. And they really thought, you know, they kept on asking District 6s, what are these love letters? And to, I think, everybody's sort of dismay, they realized it was actually the eviction notices that people were issued in the 1960s and 1970s. And so District 6s, in a really traditional way of sort of making fun of very serious situations as a way to deal with them, renamed these eviction notices as love letters. And how we are deconceptualizing it now is that the museum is really facing the threat of its doors closing, and love letters for District 6s are associated with that. But we want to spin that term on its head again. And we really want people to send us a love letter, but this time with love and with care, and to signify why the museum should stay open. And so we've been asking people for donations on those, on that basis.
Okay, so love and care and a little bit of money thrown in there, which will help keep it all afloat.
Yes.
Just as a matter of interest, I mean, I know one of the things about District 6 Museum is the storytelling, but also it's a museum of wonderful pieces from those past. Are there any of those existing, those original love letters?
So one of the other myths around when you're working in the museum is that you can never find the love letter. So it's very rarely that you actually find an original eviction notice, and sometimes we have to rely on other archives to provide it to us. But once in a while, we do actually get an official eviction notice. And so it's one of those items, whenever we have an exhibition, we always ask, where's the love letter? And that's how the term has become known for us, how we've termed it. And so I think that when we are telling the stories of District 6s in the museum space, I think we always emphasize personal storytelling, oral histories, and that's largely in the absence of those records of people's lives, the physical records, the rent cards, the post that used to come through the mail with your address on, and that is largely missing from the museum's collection. And so what we've really focused on is people and their stories.
So the people are the artifacts themselves in many ways. 1994 it started. What was its mission then?
I think essentially the mission was very clear to keep the memory of District 6 alive and to do this by involving District 6s and how they do that. But at the time, the emphasis really was on ensuring that a restitution process happens. And so that, yes, while we have a space where people can remember the past, talk about it, share the experiences, at the same time, there was an activism around it. It was about telling the story in order to ensure that people could come back to District 6.
So the storytelling, it's absolutely integral to the whole thing, really. Some people are better at telling stories than others. Some people are very good at telling stories, but they might not necessarily be based on the truth. And to tell a story from all those years ago, you have to really dig into your memory bank. Did you have workshops to try and help people access those sometimes possibly buried memories?
So I think the joy, I think, and both the challenge of working with memory and people remembering is that we have to accept that people don't always remember facts. They don't remember the past as you would like them to remember the past or to relay their story. And so the joy of working with memory is that what people tell us is their experience. And their experience and their need to share that story is actually what is central. So yes, you can do archival research. You can find out all the facts about District 6 that you possibly could find. You could look at photographs. But what is really essential is that the way in people tell this story and why they're telling that story to you in that particular moment, that is really key. It's key to this idea of healing for people. I think what apartheid did, and especially the Group Areas Act, it took people's dignity. And so when we speak about restitution in relation to District 6, yes, it's about land claims and it's about the bricks and mortar issues. But at the same time, it's about how do you restore people's dignity? How do you get people to a place where the trauma is acknowledged, even if they're telling you a story and you know the story is ambling along and it's, you know, it's missing pieces, it's missing landmarks, it's missing sites. What is really key is that this person feels that safety in telling you that story. And I think for that reason, the museum is a very important space in the city. And I think there should be more spaces like the museum and more projects like the museum that really essentially are trying to work with people and the experience of apartheid. Because apartheid is not, it's not a dead thing for many people. It's a living memory. And we have to work with those experiences and that trauma in order to move into the future, essentially.
I mean, in this particular instance, apartheid is the villain. That's the big baddie. But all over the world, there have been issues. All over the country, there are ongoing issues. And I suppose that the concept of memory accessing and storytelling is a healing thing that we use, could and should be used more widely across the world. But just going back to people telling their stories as a healing thing, some people remember, some people don't. Very often it helps you remember if you're working in a group. Somebody might say, but I remember XYZ or this particular person or that particular place. Do you find that, is that something that you work with actively, group memories?
I think that is probably the most exciting and the most important thing that we do, is that we bring former residents together and we don't record sometimes these workshops that we're having. Sometimes it's people getting together for a workshop, they're busy with a particular project, and in that space of creating something, of speaking to each other, the sharing doesn't necessarily always happen with us as the museum. It happens between people. And I think the group context for that is very important. Obviously, when there are groups involved, there are also fights involved. And so there's contestation. Some people will literally, they will have huge arguments about where they remember a particular site is or remembering particular characters. And in that moment, I think that is when the meaning of District 6, the importance of District 6 is really central. It's a space where there isn't one version of history. Everybody has the experience. Everybody has the right to tell us and tell each other what the experience is. And I think that is really, it's very powerful when you see it in action. Sometimes it's scary because the fights that happen can be quite sort of monumental, because people, in telling their story, the fights are monumental because in telling their story, people are trying to claim something. They're trying to claim a part of their past that they feel was disregarded. And so the fights are passionate. It's about, you know, I want to remember this. This is my version of my story. And I think we have developed a practice that really allows for that. And what is really central, I think, to people sharing, talking about their past is also the creativity. So when you're in the workshop process, it's not just a group interview with someone. People are literally creating artworks. They become artists. They draw. They create sculptures. And so creativity is really key to unlocking trauma. It's key to unlocking people's willingness to feel safe and to be able to share with you.
And memory is at the root of all that. Interesting that I suppose how people remember things differently reflects the bigger problems that we have in society generally. You might get two family members who remember something very different, and there can be all sorts of issues around that. But it's also a potential for healing the conflict. You know, if somebody remembers something in a particular way, somebody remembers it differently, it's an opportunity to look at what the middle ground could possibly be. It doesn't have to, excuse the expression, be black and white. There could be sort of middle ground. As much as there are fights, are there comings together?
No, there's lots of middle ground. I think the practice is about, you know, contestation. It's about remembering differently. But I think that's maybe where the museum steps in and says, like, we have the right to be able to tell our stories, share them. But at the same time, if we are working towards a particular goal, whether it's creating a mural for the new District 6 Community Hospital, how we create together is through debate. And at the end of the day, it's about compromise and it's about working together. And so I think that is really key. So the fights happen, but then the next day or the next week, people are back and they're working together as well. It's a spirit of cooperation. It's a spirit of respect between former residents, I think. And then that translates into the artwork that we are creating or the designs that we are creating.
To whom is storytelling more important, would you say? To the person who's telling the story or to the person who's receiving it?
That's something I think about quite a bit. I think sometimes when you are trained to do oral history or be an oral historian, this idea of objectivity is thrown at you. So you need to have a questionnaire. You need to be able to get to certain questions. And I think the experience at the museum has really been that it's a conversation. And so what happens in an interview is not so much about objectivity and being able to get facts. It's about how we engage with each other and share stories. And so the person who's telling the story is the author of their life history. They know it. And at the same time, we can't create this idea of an objective researcher or objective interviewer. It doesn't exist. We exist in relation to each other. And storytelling then is shared. Storytelling is about telling a story, receiving it, adapting your worldview, asking the questions. And that happens between the interviewee and the interviewer as well. And that relationship is... it's pivotal. It's a fantastic relationship. It leads to fantastic conversations. And it allows people also to not feel like they're just research subjects because the museum tries not to be, I suppose, a space where we just create the exhibitions. The exhibition, the ethos, the spirit of the exhibition is actually all the things that happens in the background. It's how we're able to engage in those conversations, have a cup of coffee before we start the workshops, how we can gossip about each other's lives, and we know what's happening in each other's lives. And we are really fantastic. We are really fantastic. But I think what's really fantastic is that we've got so many elders, 60s, in the 70s, in the 50s, we've got workshop members that are sometimes 10 years old, and there's a community that emerges. And for me, it's a community of storytelling.
Just stop you there. That's really interesting, because I was going to say, how important is storytelling intergenerationally? Because very often, and you will know this, I'm sure, you get granddad or great-granddad telling a story, and the very little children might be interested, but the teenagers are switching off. We say, oh, God, you know, mum's going on again, dad's going on, etc. Why is it important that stories should hop generations? And how can one make sure that they are interesting, A, and relevant, B?
I think when it comes to intergenerational storytelling, I think your entry point will always be the younger person in that conversation, I think. Because, you know, sometimes when you make assumptions about the youth or this, they're not interested, they don't know this. They're hungry. They're hungry for information. They're hungry for understanding where they come from, who their parents are, but the opportunities aren't necessarily there because, you know, we're locked into family traditions, ways of speaking with our elders. And I think that intergenerational storytelling, when it's organized in a sense, it creates a freedom for a younger person to say, I actually have the right and the ability to ask my elder, what was it like growing up during apartheid? What was it like to sit in a bus that was segregated or to use a separate entrance? And I think the entry point for me, for younger people, is especially important because I think when you're speaking about apartheid to younger people today, they literally do not know what it means. They have no concept of it. They can't fathom it. It's a process of education. So being able to share with them, this is what apartheid means. And I think once you introduce them to an elder and once they go back to their families and do the interviews, it opens up a whole new vista in terms of understanding their own family's history and I think the city's history as well.
Yeah, I guess by listening to stories from the past, it does help you identify who you are, where you are coming from. But how is it relevant? How do you ensure that it's relevant to young people? I mean, I said at the beginning there that storytelling is a way of making sense of the present and protecting the future from the past mistakes. How do you explain to young people that this happened and this is how it impacts your life now?
So we've worked with obviously quite a lot of young people over the years. And what ends up happening is that we have young people who stay with the organization and the museum for years after they've completed a project, for example. And I think, you know, on a basic practical level, what actually ends up happening is that we workshop them through the process of, you know, like what is apartheid basically? And we have a wonderful education program where they are literally separated into racial groups. They're separated, they're discriminated against. And so the visceral experience of being moved, of not given enough resources, becomes very clear and apparent to them, I think. And without that kind of sort of creating that visceral moment, that light bulb that goes off in their heads about, like, this is actually, you know, what my mother would have gone through, my father would have gone through, it's still a textbook understanding what apartheid is. And I think that visceral experience is really key to sort of creating the willingness within young people to actually understand, well, if I felt like this during just an hour workshop at the museum, like, how do I start asking the questions of my parents about what was their experience like? And so I think for that reason, it's a journey. So it starts at one point, and at some point, children, young people, they're not ready to hear it. They, you know, they have their own social lives. They have their own sort of concerns. So they're not necessarily interested in how did apartheid affect my parents. But there are young people who leave the museum and they become part of our programs. And over a series of workshops and years, they really start understanding the history of the city. And I say that in the sense that sometimes when we try to talk about relevance, we want to measure it. We want to quantify it and say that we had 10,000 learners come through the doors and we workshopped them in oral histories and they can do intergenerational interviews and those things. But I think relevance is actually just marked by how you shift people's attitudes and their perceptions of themselves and their own histories. Mm-hmm. And that is not quantifiable.
Yes, very, very, very good point. So that's the intergenerational issue. What about intercountry or international issue? Because people, you know, we know about, we experience apartheid then and now, but when people come from Germany or Holland or China or wherever they come from, what did they experience? And have you found that they relate it to something that's happened in their country instead of just coming and looking at us? Do they see that this is part of a bigger message?
When we have those experiences, it's always eye-opening for us as staff members and storytellers on the floor, because you have people coming from countries like the US or from European countries, and they, first of all, they can't believe that this really sort of, the system of the Group Areas Act were existent and was implemented on that scale. But it's interesting, they're able to sort of connect with the horrors of the Group Areas Act, but they don't necessarily make the link between what is happening in District 6 in Cape Town, South Africa at that moment, with what is happening in their own countries. So the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And so they don't necessarily make the direct link. And so for me, it's always interesting to figure out what is that disconnect between one's own sense of self and the history that you know. And you go to a different country and your connection feels more, it seems as though you have more of a connection with that country's story. And I think we try to bridge the gap through personal storytelling. And so we have former residents on the floor who are able to share personal experiences. And that really becomes the entry point then, I think, for dialogue. If you're doing a tour in Cape Town, you know the highlights that are going to be told to you. You know exactly what's going to be said almost. But once you hear in a personal account of what that experience is like, I think that's when, especially international visitors come through the museum's door, it's the same experience. They leave with that light bulb moment as well. And I think that's the success of the museum, is that, yes, we encourage you to read the exhibitions. Yes, we encourage you to do this, that, or the other. But it's your connection with a person telling their story that is actually the thing that will remain with you when you leave.
Perfect cue for me to ask you your story, Christian. You are young in terms of the forced removals. I don't know what you remember, but just give us your picture. That's a big question. Let me narrow it down for you. How did your parents tell you what happened to them, and how did you use that in your own life?
I always reflect on that, because I think, you know, it's no coincidence that you end up working and are committed to a museum about forced removals. I remember one of my colleagues, long-standing member of the museum, Noor Ibrahim, he always says, now he remembers that I used to come and visit the museum before I worked there. And I always think about what was it about the space that connected with me. And I remember, and then it starts you on your own journey thinking about what are the stories of forced removals in your own family. And when I was younger, and you're a teenager, and you are not interested in the stories that your parents are telling you, they, you know, they stand by your door, they want to tell you something about like this family member or the past, and then you just, you know, you shoo them out of the room. They shouldn't be there. And I remember doing that so clearly, I think, with my father in particular. And the stories he would always be telling me, you know, standing in the doorway, or just like vague phrases he would throw in my direction, was about forced removals. And both my parents grew up in Paarl and were forcibly removed in Paarl. And a lot of the artwork that my father created was around that experience, about the loss of connection to the Berg River, for example, having to sort of be in one school at the one end of town and then all of a sudden be shifted to another school. The fact that I was baptized at the church in Paarl, for example, and for many Perelita, as they say, for people from Paarl, how that became sort of a bastion for them. So what I remember, interestingly enough, is those phrases that he used to throw my way. And, you know, you're going on drives on Sundays to visit family and things he would point out. And I think for me, that was didn't sink in until I started thinking about oral histories. Where do I want to work when I'm older? Like, what do I want to commit myself to? And the museum became that space where I thought, okay, it looks like you able to tell your story. I remember the stories that my father used to tell me. And I think for me, that's my fascination with oral history, in a space where I didn't have the opportunity to sit down and talk with him about what his experiences were like. I realized a lot of that generation didn't necessarily speak about their pain and their trauma and their childhood memories, for that matter. For me, oral history and storytelling allows, it's important to create that formal space. We talk about, you know, the informal spaces of groups and just sharing and talking, but it's really important to also create a structure around that so that people do have that opportunity and that they know that the opportunity is there. They might not take it up. And I think for me, that's the connection. It's about hearing these fragments as I was growing up. And for myself, trying to build that up, build out those fragments as I've become older and you're reflecting on your own family's history and past.
Well, you've clearly thought about it a great deal, but it's what you do, isn't it? But build, I like the idea of building fragments. And I suppose, just lastly, some people will be very entertaining and very good at telling their stories, and some people will be very, as you say, rambly and they go off. Do you have storytelling lessons? Do you help people build their fragments into something cohesive?
So one of my colleagues, Mandy Sanger, does that, and then she will be exhausted by the end of the workshop, I think. Because, you know, when you're sharing your story, and District 6s especially, they love to talk about District 6. They'll tell you everything from where they were born, the roads that you saw, the, like, characters.
And the food they ate.
The food they ate, everything. The gossip, they'll tell you the gossip as well. And what we've what has been a evolution, I think, for us in a learning curve is that when we started bringing personal storytelling onto the museum floor, realizing that as much as we want to share that story with a visitor doesn't have the time to have a long conversation over coffee and cassista. And so you have to structure what you're going to tell them. And the process of structuring one's personal story for that experience is difficult because it's about training District 6s themselves to be storytellers in a way that you know how to build up to the climax of your own story. You're able to highlight the historical information that's in the museum. But at the same time, while you're trying to create this narrative with them, at the same time, the space of storytelling is therapy. And you have to make the time for that. So it's not a case about this character has his story, we're going to train him in this way, and so we'll create a lovely narrative that we can, you know, provide to visitors. In the process of training, a lot of things comes up for a lot of people. People's insecurities about speaking to the public, about remembering how they remember. Maybe they've remembered something in a very particular way, and then the museum says, no, but we've actually got the historical information about this, and, you know, we think that maybe your memory is wrong. And so those conversations, they are difficult. They're taxing, I think, both on the storytellers and the museum staff, because it really tests our commitment to the power of the personal story. It tests our commitment to this idea of multiple narratives. But I think it's a necessary sort of evolution that we're going through at the moment. And to watch District 6s go through it when they're in their 60s and their 70s and they're asking my colleague, you know, why do I have to write my story down? It's all in my head. Why do I have to create these highlights? You know, I can just say it off the top of my head. And that dynamic, I think, is fantastic, because I think that is what ensures resilience for the next 25 years of the museum's life. It ensures the resilience. I think memory is dynamic. It changes. And I think it's important that that contestation between the staff and District 6s exists. I think it's almost the lifeblood of the kind of work that we do.
Well, I think the District 6 Museum is very much part of the lifeblood, the life river of lifeblood that exists in Cape Town. And I think, as I hear you, the art of storytelling may be difficult, but it's infinitely fascinating. Yeah. And hopefully the District 6 will continue for another 25 years and beyond for all the reasons that you've mentioned. Christiane, thank you very much. If anybody would like to know more about the love letters, about the campaign, I know that you're opening by appointment now and again, but we're here right behind you hoping that the District 6 Museum will live and open very, very soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And if you would like any more information, do check in. If you can't check in directly to the museum, find out more on their website, which is district6.co.za, district6.co.za. Christiane and Julius, thank you very much.
Thank you.